Well, I expect that many of you have come tonight because you've heard that I'm speaking on the subject of this book, The God Delusion, by Richard Dawkins. But I'm conscious, too, that some people might have come along to an evening service and know nothing at all about the book, The God Delusion, and think, well, I don't know anything about it, so what on earth am I going to get out of this talk? So just very, very briefly and simply, the book, The God Delusion, is an attack on all religion and Christianity in particular, because it's the local one here in this country. And Peter has helpfully put on some flyers he put around the church previously, a quote from the preface to the book, which says, "If this book works as I intend, religious readers who open it will be atheists when they put it down." That basically sums up Richard Dawkins' aim and desire to destroy faith. And I confess, I did not read it for ages because I don't come from a scientific background. I've got science O-levels, but nothing beyond that. And I thought, I will not be able to tell whether the arguments he puts forward are strong or weak. We had, for example, a discussion in our Hot Potatoes discussion group a little while back about creation and evolution. And various arguments were put forward for a creationist point of view, and various arguments were put forward against that view, and I haven't a clue how solid or robust those arguments are, because I'm not a scientist, because I'm not a geologist, because I just am not versed in those areas. And so, as I say, I was quite wary of reading Dawkins. To give you an example from my own field, with great delight, as we have some Swedish guests here tonight, there was a time in the 1970s, particularly among archaeologists, and it goes on to some extent to today, when the archaeologists looked at the finds that they were making, and they said the Vikings were peaceful people. To quote W. Holmquist in one of my favourite books about the Vikings, Swedish Vikings on Helja and Birka, "The foremost task of the fleets of armed traders was not to raid and to plunder. It was the very opposite. Their task was to establish and maintain the peaceful exchange of trade. It was the era of the peaceful Viking. That they came to bloody blows now and again is scarcely to be wondered at. Such things still happen today." This is called the whitewash. And the archaeologist said, "When we dig up our settlements, we find plenty of evidence of trade, but we don't find dead bodies with arrows in them or axes in their heads. So obviously they've had a bad press, bad PR." The trouble is that the historians who read all the written texts, which describe the murder, the burnings, the plunderings and the destruction, say, "Actually, hang on a minute, you know, we've got some other evidence that shows they were the nasty brutes that we've always said." And you could read the archaeologist's book and think, "Oh my goodness, I've completely misunderstood the Vikings. They were lovely, friendly people." But it's only half the story. And the fact is there's truth in both. You need to know both sets of evidence. And when you put the two together, you get a much truer picture, a more nuanced picture. And so I didn't read Dawkins because I thought, I just don't know whether this is going to be one-sided, like the archaeologists in the 70s, or whether there'll be a clear message of scientific truth that I can make sense of. And the two, I finally got round to reading it. And to my surprise, it isn't a very scientific book. It's a book about science, and as I'll show, it makes enormous claims for science. But actually, the scientific arguments are extremely slender. And actually, I found it rather a tedious book at times, because the same arguments are put forward again and again in different chapters in slightly different ways. And it feels like someone who's having a bit of a rant, like one of those people who traps you in the corner of a bar and wants to tell you their pet theory at inordinate length, and you cannot possibly see a way out of it. Reminds me of, he's an Oxford Don, it reminds me of someone who said, "Oh, I knew I was in Oxford when I was walking down the street, and I heard two men having a discussion, and one of them said to the other one, 'And ninthly, my dear fellow.'" And it feels like he's grabbing anything he can grab hold of and throwing it at religion. Some of the arguments being strong, some of them being quite weak. But anything I can throw in, I will. But I think it's a 450-page book, okay? So I'm not going to do it justice. I'm not even going to represent it fairly in that I'm just going to pick out a little of what he says. But I hope, I believe, it's the main planks of what he says. And so I'm not going to go into great detail and tackle things in great detail. I shall pick examples out. But to me, there are two main arguments in the book. And the first one is this: religion is a bad thing, because religion causes all sorts of evils in the world, all sorts of war, all sorts of conflict, all sorts of division. And religious people do horrible things. And he has many examples which are deeply embarrassing of horrible things Christians have said about him, which are shameful and indefensible, frankly. And he made a whole TV series about the fact that religion is a bad thing. That's one of his main arguments. The second main argument is that God is a hypothesis. The existence of God is a scientific hypothesis which can be examined like any other theory. And he would say the evidence for it, in his eyes, is weak. And the evidence that everything in the world can be explained by another cause, natural selection, is, in his eyes, much simpler and more plausible. So I'm going to take those two arguments one at a time. First of all, the claim that religion is a bad thing, and second, the argument that the evidence for God is weak. So the first point, is religion a bad thing? Well, he's had so many debates with Christians, I don't know if anything would surprise him anymore, but from the book it would seem that Dawkins would be surprised that I would agree totally. And many of us would agree that religion is a bad thing. That we know all sorts of examples of religion, organized religion, causing hurt and damage and pain, frankly, to many of us, as well as to the world, as well as to many people out there. What Dawkins does not seem to be aware of, or doesn't want to admit to, is the fact that there is a huge distinction between faith, which is a personal, spiritual thing. I haven't read the book looking for it, but I don't think the word spiritual crops up very often at all. It's not a book that grapples with spirituality, with the spiritual quest and hunger that is in, I believe, everybody, and that we see all around us, whether in religious people or non-religious people. Faith, which is a personal spiritual thing, and religion, which is an organized structural thing. And many Christians would say, if you want to put a label on it, many born-again Christians, people who have come into a relationship with God, would say, is that, yeah, religion is a turn-off. We believe in faith. We believe in a personal God. Let me give an example, which is mentioned in the book again and again and again, and that is Northern Ireland. Richard Dawkins repeatedly says, very insistently, that the conflict in Northern Ireland is not a political one, but a religious one. He says, don't try and label it Republican versus Unionist. It's actually about Catholic versus Protestant. I beg to differ very strongly, because the conflict that we see is between two sets, two groups with a different tribal identity. And sure, they are bound up with the labels Protestant and Catholic, but actually they have their roots in society, in politics, as I say, in tribal identity, not in personal faith issues. And to give you a clear illustration from a secular perspective of someone who sees the difference, let me read you a tiny little cutting in the Daily Telegraph newspaper in 1993, which moved me profoundly. On Thursday, at Machaberry Jail in County Antrim, Anne Moore, the Republican terrorist serving life for the murder of 11 soldiers and 6 civilians in the 1982 bombing in Ballykelly, plans to marry Bobby Corrie, another terrorist jailed for life for murder, but in the Unionist interest. Both Moore and Corrie have become born-again Christians and renounced violence. That's the difference between religion and faith. Someone who murdered because they came from, quote, the Catholic community, actually the Republican community. Someone who murdered because they were in the, quote, Protestant community, actually the Unionist community. Finding faith, finding religion in its lively sense, in its real sense, in its true sense, the relationship with God. And realizing then that actually there was more that united them than divided them, and turning to peace. That's the difference which Dawkins does not see. So I agree that Christians have done many bad things. I cringe at the quotes in the book, and I have experienced the same myself. in 30 years as a Christian. Christians who do bad things. I could write a book about the terrible things that Christianity has done over the years. But equally, and this is something that Dawkins doesn't seem to recognise, I could write a book about science being a terrible thing. And the awful thing that scientists have done in the name of science over the years. Let's just take one tiny episode. Nazi Germany between 1933 and 1945. In Auschwitz, Dr. Mengele performed his abhorrent experiments on twins, on Allied prisoners of war, without anaesthetic. Terribly, horribly cruel. In the light of that, should we ban all medical research? Should we ban biology? During the Nazi period, there was a planned experiment in eugenics, in breeding out those who were seen as less than perfect humanity, and in breeding lots and lots of Aryans, pure Nazi stock. Should we therefore ban all genetics and stop all geneticists from practicing? There were the V2 rockets, one of which crashed down on Park Road. You can still see the plaque on the corner of the street recording where many innocent civilians died from a V2 rocket. Those were developed by physicists who later went on to work in the Apollo program, some of them, in the United States. Do we ban physics? You see, there are good scientists and there are bad scientists. There's good science and there's bad science. And there's science that's used for good ends and there's science that's used for bad ends. It doesn't mean that science in itself is a bad thing. There are religious people who do very good things. One of the major criticisms in the reviews of the book is he doesn't seem to acknowledge that at all. And yes, there are times when religion is used for evil ends. It doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with faith. To give another illustration from a similar vein, Dawkins is very keen on Charles Darwin, quotes him again and again. Look in the index and you'll see how many times Darwin is referred to and quoted. This is the man who wrote, "The chief distinction in the intellectual powers of the two sexes is shown by man's attaining," and we mean the word man there, "by man's attaining to a higher eminence in whatever he takes up than can women, whether requiring deep thought, reason or imagination, or merely the use of the senses and hands. Man has ultimately become superior to woman." How about that, ladies? Now, and I could give you another similar quote from Darwin to show this was something he really did believe. I haven't sort of misquoted it or twisted it. Now, that doesn't mean that everything Charles Darwin found in other areas was wrong. It just means that in some areas he was a man of his time and he didn't get it entirely right. And Dawkins does indeed say we should not judge the people of the past by the standards of our own day. But as you read the book, you find he does it again and again and again about Christian writers. He savages Martin Luther for his Luther's totally indefensible rants against the Jews, as if that dismisses and destroys Luther's credibility in any other area. But if we exclude the flaws of somebody for one thing they said, well, I'm afraid Darwin goes out as well. No, we recognise that there is good in everybody, potentially, but there is bad in everyone, potentially, too. While we're looking at other things that are bad things, what about atheism? Is atheism a bad thing? And Dawkins discusses particularly Stalin and Hitler at some length and says, individual atheists may do evil things, but they don't do evil things in the name of atheism. He admits that Stalin was almost certainly an atheist. But what he doesn't seem to recognize is that actually Stalin did do a lot of things in the name of atheism. He did try and destroy the church quite deliberately, quite consciously, and over a long period of time. In his recent book, Young Stalin, Simon Sebag Montefiore says, "The dictator mercilessly suppressed the church and murdered and deported priests." That was his plan. If you look at Pol Pot in Kampuchea, you see someone who did even greater tyranny against his own people in the name of abolishing all religion, murdering hundreds of thousands, trying to destroy religion once and for all, and to allow atheism to reign supreme. It's just not true that nobody has done evil things in the name of atheism. Now, I'm not saying for a moment that this means that Richard Dawkins, because he's an atheist, is likely to become a mass murderer. No, I recognise there is good and bad in all of us. But let us not dismiss religion because of some of the bad things that religious people have done, or even some of the bad things that religion itself has done. And let us see that there is a huge distinction between religion as organization, religion as dogma, and religion that is expressed as faith, which, as we saw in the prison of Northern Ireland, can change lives. Because our testimony, most of us here tonight, is that faith can bring freedom and forgiveness from the past, from its guilt and its shame, which is a good thing. Can bring peace and joy and meaning and purpose in the present, which is a fantastic thing. And can give hope for the future, so that we no longer need fear death, which is a wonderful thing. That's what faith can do. Can do it for Richard Dawkins. It's what faith has done for many of us. Faith, for me, is a wonderful thing because it's changed my life and given me all those wonderful things. It turns terrorists to peacemakers. How can that be a bad thing? And then to look at his second point, is the evidence for God weak? If God is a scientific hypothesis and we analyse the evidence for God, what do we make of it? I find it ironic that Sir Isaac Newton, one of the greatest scientists that's ever lived, said, "In the absence of any other proof, the thumb alone would convince me of God's existence." But I don't lay great weight on that as an argument against Dawkins, because Newton was a scientist of his time. And there are many, many things that Newton did not know and actually, in a sense, got wrong, because we've discovered an awful lot more. But to me, this is a very bizarre argument about looking for the scientific evidence for God. As the farmer said in Cornwall when asked by a tourist how to get to Polperro, "Well, if I were you, I wouldn't start from here." Because if I was looking for the existence of God and evidence for the existence of God, I wouldn't start by looking at a scientific hypothesis. Frankly, I wouldn't start with a theological hypothesis. That is that God is that which there is nothing greater. Discuss. No, that's not where I would start at all. But funnily enough, Dawkins just dismisses philosophy and theology with an airy wave of the hand. He says this on page 80 of the book: "It's a tedious cliche, and unlike many cliches, it isn't even true, that science concerns itself with how questions, but only theology is equipped to answer why questions. What on earth is a why question?" Now, I don't actually think that's a fair representation of the truth. I don't think it is a cliche, because I know very, 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 very few people who would say that only theology is equipped to answer why questions. Theology, yes, and philosophy also looks at why questions. Why are we here? But I think I cannot believe that he really doesn't know what a why question is. I think he's just playing with us there and ducking the argument. Because it's quite clear that for many people in philosophy, leaving aside theology, in philosophy, it's quite clear that there's a distinction between the scientific question and the philosophical question. Sir Peter Medawar, a definite rationalist who won the Nobel Prize for his work on immunology, wrote in a book called The Limits of Science that there is indeed a limit upon science is made very likely by the existence of questions that science cannot answer and that no conceivable advance of science could empower it to answer. I have in mind such questions as, how did everything begin? What are we all here for? What is the point of living? Note, none of them why questions, but in a sense, actually, all of them why questions. So there are those who would strongly disagree with Dawkins over the existence of why questions and the ability of science to answer them. Stephen Jay Gould, another populist biologist who wrote many a well-respected book, wrote this in a book called Rocks of Ages: "I do not see how science and religion could be unified or even synthesized, but I do not understand why the two enterprises should experience any conflict. Science tries to document the factual character of the natural world and to develop theories that coordinate and explain those facts. Religion, on the other hand, operates in the equally important but utterly different realm of human purposes, meanings, and values. And he goes on in a passage which Dawkins quotes to cite the old cliche, science gets the age of rocks and religion the rock of ages. Science studies how the heavens go, religion how to go to heaven. And Dawkins says, to me, incredibly patronisingly, I simply do not believe that Gould could possibly have meant much of what he wrote in Rocks of Ages. Notice that is not an argument. That is not engaging in discussion. That's saying, I just don't get that. I don't want to talk about it. Let's rule it out altogether. So it seems that Dawkins is saying science can answer everything. You have a question, whether it starts with who, how, what, or when, science can answer it. And philosophy says, no, I'm sorry, I beg to differ. And the interesting thing is, scientists themselves, not just Christian apologetic scientists, but other scientists too, say, no, there are questions which science can't answer. We know our limitations, and we leave those questions to the theologians, if we have some kind of a faith, a respect for faith. Or even if we don't have respect for faith, we at least leave it to the philosophers or the ethicists. Now, Dawkins is trying to claim territory for science, which I don't think science can claim. And also, and this is dearer to my own heart, he does the same with history. There's a quote in the book about the resurrection of Jesus, which to me is the pivotal point of my Christian faith, the heart of why I'm a Christian. He says, did Jesus raise Lazarus from the dead? Did he himself come alive again 3 days after being crucified? There's an answer to every such question, whether or not we can discover it in practice, and it is a strictly scientific answer. No! I'm sorry. Apologies to any scientists here, but it's a historical question. It's not a scientific question. Yes, there is science bound up in it. Of course there is. But if something happened in the past is a historical question, please don't push your science so far that you push history out of the equation. Did Henry VIII ever live? What did he look like? What was his diet? Did he marry all those wives? Did he divorce them? What was the result of those divorces? These are all scientific questions. No, they're not. Science may have an impact on them, but they are historical questions. And as Tom Wright, the Bishop of Durham, says so for me, so helpfully and profoundly, we must never forget that science, by definition, studies the repeatable, whereas history, by definition, studies the unrepeatable. Think about that for a minute. How can I test out if a scientific hypothesis is true? Is water H2O? Well, I can do some experiments with hydrogen, with oxygen, and with water, and I can establish, yes, when I do the experiment, it also comes out as H2O. How can I tell whether Henry VIII married those wives? Tell me what experiment I can do to find out if it's true or not. I can't. There is no historical experiment, at least yet known to man, that can bring Henry VIII back. Possibly, you know, they'll do something with DNA and clone him, you know. But I doubt it, frankly. And what we do with history is we look at the past and we say, how plausible is it? What's the evidence for it? How plausible is it, given all the evidence we've got, that the Vikings did this, or Henry VIII did that, or that Jesus rose from the dead, or that Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead? Those are the kind of questions that we have to ask, and it's right to ask. Let's look at the evidence and say, how plausible is this, given the evidence, given all the evidence? Now, it seems to me that Dawkins leaves himself a large amount of wriggle room on this area. Because in another context, talking not this time about miracles, but about an argument of irreducible complexity, don't worry about that, but another area, but I think this applies to miracles too, he says this. Imagine you're watching a really great magic trick. The argument from personal incredulity screams from the depths of my pre-scientific brain centers and almost compels me to say, it must be a miracle. There is no scientific explanation. It's got to be supernatural. But the still small voice of scientific education speaks a different message. There is a perfectly good explanation. It is just that I'm too naive, or too unobservant, or too unimaginative to think of it. In other words, even if a miracle were to be performed in front of Richard Dawkins' own eyes, someone with inoperable cancer were to be healed, someone who was blind is made to see, Richard Dawkins would say, it seems to me from his book, page 155, he would say, I don't understand it at the moment, I can't explain it at the moment, but that's only because I'm too naive or too unobservant or too unimaginative to think of a reason. That's his wiggle room. If you present me with anything that happened in the past that doesn't fit in with my scientific worldview, then either it's been wrongly reported or wrongly transmitted or wrongly understood, and it can't have happened. Now, Dawkins says he is not a fundamentalist. He does not like fundamentalism. Fair enough. But he says, I'm not a fundamentalist because if you give me the evidence that challenges my view, I will change my mind. I'm sorry, that's not what I'm reading on page 155. What I'm reading is, if you show me evidence that doesn't fit in with my worldview, I will dismiss it as impossible, incredible, incomprehensible. And it seems to me that is fundamentalist. And it is not being open to historical truth. Because I do believe that Jesus rose from the dead. Uniquely. Nobody else did it before. Nobody else did it since. And if Jesus uniquely rose from the dead, then that means the things he said about himself, including the fact that he was going to rise from the dead, bear unique scrutiny. Because uniquely, he has authority which speaks to me today. And so, I have to take his claim seriously. If the evidence that's reported is correct. But here again, Dawkins isn't happy. He says on page 118, well, you can't believe those things you read in the Bible. Ever since the 19th century, scholarly theologians have made an overwhelming case that the Gospels are not reliable accounts of what happened in the history of the real world. All were written long after the death of Jesus. All were then copied and recopied through many different Chinese whispers generations by fallible scribes who, in any case, had their own religious agendas. Three mistakes there. First one, scholarly theologians say they're not reliable accounts. Well, yes, you can find scholars who will say these are not reliable accounts ever since the 19th century. But you can also find an awful lot of very eminent biblical scholars who will say we believe these are reliable accounts. We believe that the evidence is as good for the events of the life of Jesus, even if we do not understand them fully, as they are for the life of Nero, or the life of Julius Caesar, or other people who lived at the time. So you will find many scholars who will defend the authenticity, the reliability, the historicity of the New Testament. Second disagreement, copied and recopied by scribes who, what he's saying, isn't it, couldn't record it correctly, who changed it over the course of the years. Again, wrong. Well, wrong in the substance. If you look at any good Greek New Testament, such as I suspect Sylvester was given not long before he left theological college, then it has at the bottom of the page all the textual variants that we know from all the manuscripts which we know, which are in their thousands. Yes, there are differences, but it's differences like they and them, and sometimes he or they. They are minor differences. There are two passages in the Gospels which in your Bible, in your seat, if you pick it up and have a look at John 8 or the end of Mark, it says these passages are not found in the best manuscripts. How many are there? Two. In how many Gospels? Four. All the Gospels. And the other passages are recorded and attested by witness after witness after witness after witness in the same form with minor alterations which make no real difference to the meaning. So that's, I'm afraid, not true either. And the manuscripts go back to very soon after the time they were written. Third, and to me the most significant fault here, all were written long after the death of Jesus. As though you can't believe this because it was written so late. Well, that's true of these other Gospels that people keep popping up with these days, the Gospel of Judas or the Gospel of Philip. But it's not true of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. To take Mark's Gospel, which is the earliest, pretty much all New Testament scholars in the main body of the scholarly community will agree that Mark's Gospel was written around 60 to 62 AD, which is some 30 years after the death of Jesus. Now, for some of us, you know, 30 years might seem an enormously long time. It's probably longer than some of you ever lived. But actually, for some of us, it's not very long at all, much to our chagrin. I can remember vividly what was happening 30 years ago. Oh, don't laugh at my photograph. It's supposed to show you that I was there. This is me in Baden-Baden in Germany, where I lived for 3 months in the early summer of 1978. I can remember vividly many things that happened there, many people I met there. I can remember Lothar, the conscientious objector that I worked with. I remember the eve of my 19th birthday as we sat in a pub together and I said, just the two of us, and I was desperately homesick, saying, oh, in 10 minutes I'm going to be 19. Feeling sorry for myself. And he said, oh, great, you can buy me a drink then. Which didn't make me feel any better. I remember watching Close Encounters of the Third Kind with him at the cinema and thinking, if only I could hear the soundtrack over all the music and the noise and the sound effects, maybe I could understand what on earth is going on. I remember the day when I dropped first one, then two pieces of crockery in the kitchen where I worked and the lady saying to me, right, you're going to drop a third one now. And I did. I can remember the elderly lady who said to me, this was in Germany, and she said to me, that's why I'm going to say it in German, du bist mein geliebter Sohn, mit dem ich wohlgefallen bin. You are my beloved son, in whom I am well pleased. And she said, I say that because you remind me of my son who was killed on the Eastern Front when he was about your age. When you remember we were enemies in that war, that was profoundly moving. I remember that. I remember it all so vividly. It was 30 years ago. I'm sure many of you can remember what happened 30 years ago, particularly if you think that these events were the most significant events in your life, because someone who had died, who you'd followed for 3 years, you saw alive again. And you went on then talking about those events for the next 30 years. Do you not think at the end of those 30 years that you'd remember it pretty well still? I do. So in real terms, this is not long after the death of Jesus, and these are not unreliable memoirs. To me, they are very reliable. And ironically, Dawkins has given me one of the best arguments I have come across in recent years for the historicity, for the proof of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, which I will use in this autumn's Alpha. He did it quite unwittingly by telling me about the cargo cults in the South Pacific in the 1940s. Now, he covers this in several pages. I'll try and explain it very briefly. What happened was in the 30s and 40s, white men came to these islands in the South Pacific bringing cargo, bringing by ship and by plane, lots of white men with incredible things such as they'd never seen before, wealth and riches and goods and objects that they'd never dreamed of for the white men. And so the belief grew up, and David Attenborough studied this, and it's written about in the book, how in island after island, the belief spontaneously grew up that one day in the future, someone would return, a great man would return, and he would bring them cargo, and he would drive the white men out and bring cargo for the indigenous people of the islands, the cargo cults. And Dawkins quotes this and says, look how gullible people are. Look how easily religions can spring up from such flimsy beginnings. What it made me think was this. The reason the cargo cult sprang up was because something happened. Something unprecedented. Things they'd never seen in their lives, things they'd never dreamed of, suddenly arrived in great numbers with these white people. It was unexpected, it was dramatic, and for them it was life-changing. And that's why they said, maybe one day it can be for us too. The crucial thing is, something happened. Something historical, something real. Something which changed their whole outlook on life, changed their whole universe. In AD 30, What happened? Something happened to change the lives of those disciples. Something unprecedented, something radical, something dramatic, something life-changing. So they started teaching and preaching that the Messiah had been crucified. Now, if you start reading about Jewish beliefs in the Old Testament, in the present, in the New Testament times, you will realize that is a balmy thing to say. Messiahs don't get crucified. Crucifixion is a curse. Crucifixion is failure. Loads of would-be messiahs were crucified. And yet they went around saying, God sent Jesus and you killed him. And the crowd must have scratched their heads and said, yeah? And they're saying, but this proves he was the Messiah. It was a radically new thought. Where did it come from? Then they said, and listen, we've seen him raised from the dead. That's how we know he was the Son of God. Now, again, if you read anything about the beliefs of the Jews at the time, if you read anything about the beliefs of the people of that area at that time, if resurrection was ever going to come, it was going to be the end of time, and everyone was going to rise to a new life. If they'd been good, to glory. If they'd been bad, who knew what was going to happen, but it probably wasn't going to be very nice. Nobody ever thought that one person would be brought back to life and life would carry on. It was totally different. It was totally crazy. It was totally new. Why did they start teaching that? Where did all this come from? And they said this. They said, do you know what? God has told us to share this good news with Romans and Greeks, and they don't have to become Jews like us. Totally unprecedented. So they were persecuted by some people for it. Why did they start getting these mad ideas from? Why did they start changing everything they held dear so that they were forced out of their communities, forced out of their synagogues, forced out of their homes, and in many cases were killed for what they believed? Seems to me probably something happened. Wonder what could have happened. What could have happened to change their lives so radically? Well, as a historian, if I look back, the obvious explanation is that what they said happened, happened. That as Lizzie read to us, what I received I passed on to you as of first importance. This is the heart of it. This is what changed it. This is what did it for me, says Paul, that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures. Forgiveness from the past. That he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures. He appeared to Peter and the 12 and more than 500 brothers that you can go and talk to today, most of whom are still living. And then, last of all, he appeared to me. Something happened. Something radical and life-changing and unexpected and unprecedented. And Paul says it didn't just happen for them, it happened for me as well. And I've met Jesus and he's changed my life. And he's given me freedom and forgiveness from the past, peace and joy and purpose amidst all the struggles of the present, and absolute cast iron certainty about the future that I'm going to be with him in his risen glory. Because something happened. Something happened on the cross. Something happened in the empty tomb. That's changed my life. And it seems to me as a historian, that's pretty good evidence that what Paul says happened, happened. And that what my faith rests in is reliable. And so the book did not work as Dawkins intended it. I was not an atheist when I put it down. In fact, I was strengthened in my faith. And I hope and pray that as you reflect on the truth of the resurrection of Jesus, on the evidence, if you dare to look at the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, you will be strengthened in faith too. Not to become religious. I'm not very keen on you all becoming religious. But to have faith. Faith which changes lives. Faith which turns terrorists into peacemakers. Faith which creates a relationship with God. Faith which gives peace, forgiveness, joy, hope. All those wonderful gifts. Faith which I hope and pray that miraculously Richard Dawkins might find too. Let's pray. God, I'm conscious I've talked a lot tonight. Many, many words that have washed over us, some of which may have gone in one ear, out the other, some of which may have sparked thoughts in our minds. Help us, Lord, to retain what you would have us retain, to take to heart what you would have us take to heart, to forget what's unimportant. But I do pray, Lord, that each one of us would dare to look seriously at the evidence for the resurrection. And I pray that we'll find in it the grounds for faith, for hope, for meaning and purpose, for peace, for joy, for life. And Lord, I do pray that for Richard Dawkins too. Please forgive those people who have written him foul and obnoxious letters. Please may he meet Christians who have grace and love in their lives. And please may we be people who respond to challenge and critique with warmth and tact and tenderness. And who, by the lives that we live and the words that we say, speak of the love and grace of Jesus. And may he meet people like that too. In your name, amen.